order, Monday, February 6, 2012, time is 8 o'clock, nope, 8:05. President, our Representative Feige, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson, absent so far is Representative Sisna, President Kawasaki, absent so far is Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Allendick. We do have a quorum. And our first order of business today is our superintendent presentation, which we're going to try some new technology. If it doesn't work, we'll go back to audio conference. But I think we're trendsetters here, and we do have Superintendent Bill McLeod in Dillingham. If you're ready to begin your presentation, sir, would you introduce yourself for the record, and please begin. We can see you very clearly, and can you hear us?
Right. They're trying to talk to me, what?
Superintendent McLeod, can you hear us well?
Well, I don't know if they're in session.
Oops. Superintendent, can you hear us?
Yeah, they didn't turn their mute back on if they're trying to talk to you. Or somebody's standing right here talking to them.
Read for these. You want to respond?
I've dropped off audio or something.
He muted it, now he can't get it back.
Yeah, we're not muted. I think they must be muted on their side.
Oh.
Our church is...
Committee will come back to order. For the record, Representative Sisson and Pruitt have joined us, and Superintendent Bill McLeod, sorry we weren't able to be trendsetters with you this morning, sir, but we do have your PowerPoint on the wall, and if you would please, for the record, introduce yourself and start with your presentation. If you just tell Annette which slide you want to be on, she'll click us through the PowerPoint presentation. If you would, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Bill McLeod, Superintendent of Dillingham City School District. And we had Skype earlier. We were able to see and talk, and then it looks like we dropped off. We could see you, but we could not hear you. Dillingham City School District, first slide, House Education Committee. First, I want to open up and thank each of you representatives for all the hard work you do down there and the good that you've done for education in the past legislative session. So thank you. As you can see, welcome to Dillingham. A little bit about our demographics. We are a hub community. We serve the region. We're what you call off the road. In other words, you fly in or boat in certain times of the year. We have year-round flights. We run about 2,500 people year-round, grow into maybe 5,000 plus during the commercial fishing season in June, July, and August. Of course, the word Tick Tick Park is the entranceway here. We're a school of 472 students, K-12 system, and we run about a $9 million annual budget. The third slide, elementary school. Our elementary school has approximately 214 kids, K-5. We do run a variety of after-school programs for the students, as well as intramurals. Our school attendance patterns have been very good, up in the 91% plus area. Academic achievement, we were very pleased last year with the progress that we saw and some of the trends. And we have a lot of parental involvement in the elementary school. When they have a program or a need, the parents come out and they are there substantially to help the kids. We also run a couple of other schools. We have an alternative school, the Maximum Achievement Program, for kids that aren't making it on the regular side of the high school. We also run a correspondence school locally. We have about 37 kids in the alternative school, 10 to 12 kids in the correspondence. It's an individualized self-paced type program. They run on mini terms, and they have an emphasis on the world of work. Most of those students attend classes half the day and work half the day, and that connection seems to help them get through school. Some of the educational goals, On the next slide, I won't go through those, but we have a strong emphasis in reading and writing. Right now, we believe that we need to get our elementary kids, particularly our primary kids, K-1-2, up to reading proficiency by the end of the third grade. We have a very strong focus on that, and most of our school initiative efforts are focused on that reading and writing proficiency, K-12, and in particular with the primary grades. We do monitor and evaluate the instruction with the universal screener, and we have a heavy emphasis on using the achievement data that we have to help us improve instruction. Achievements that we've seen, we're seeing some positive trends in reading and writing scores. Our third grade reading proficiency has increased from 55% in 2005 to an all-time high last year of 78%. And we feel very good about that. We were shooting for a three-year trend line of 80, and our school improvement initiatives that we put in down there are only in their second year, and we're seeing very positive trends there. And we call it our bubble of success. We feel if we can get our third graders up to that 80% above proficiency rate, they're going to have a very high likelihood of completing the rest of their school year successfully. Our writing proficiency in the third grade has also seen a significant increase with our new curriculum and efforts. We went from 54% in 2005 to 70%, again an all-time high in 2011. School-wide, we set a school-wide achievement goal last year. We wanted every school, the middle school, the high school, the elementary school, the alternative school, our correspondence school, to move at least 10% of our kids that were not proficiency to proficiency, with the goal of meeting the AYP target of safe harbor. We accomplished that in all schools. We feel very good about that. The next slide, one of the things the community has really invested in the last several years is renovation for both the elementary and middle school. Local bonds were passed, and approximately $15 million of local funds has went into the elementary and high school, and our facilities look good. The exteriors are in good shape. Our roofs are substantially repaired. The interior of the schools look very good. And when you walk into Dillingham City School District schools, you have a good feel for the state of the condition they're in. Challenges. Even with our successes, we realize that we have a number of challenges in the district. A big one coming up for us this year is in fiscal. Our health insurance, we just got notified of a 24% increase. In a small budget like ours, that means about $224,000 for next year. We have felt that increase already in an increase of $20,000 a month for our health insurance costs. That is really going to impact us going into next year. Our employee salary and benefits, just like everybody else in the state, we have negotiated contracts out there. They have roll-up factors. That's going to increase. As you know, out here in rural Alaska, we have unique cost factors, and we really appreciate the ICER, and we really appreciate the $93,000 approximately we received through the Senate bill for energy last year. But as you know, it's been a long, cold, dark winter out here, and our energy costs have skyrocketed. And with the BSA being flat funded last year, and if we don't get any increase next year, we're going to have a significant budget problem out here in Dillingham. You can also see on the chart there our student population trends from FY06, a steady decline through FY12, and we're anticipating a continued decline in enrollment for next year. And of course for us, for every student loss, when you roll the formula through, we're talking about a $13,000 loss per student. Another major challenge that we know is in front of us is our instruction and student achievement. We struggled to meet AYP both at the elementary and middle high school. We are on level 5, year 2 for our elementary. We are on AYP level 5, year 3 for the secondary. And we have implemented a number of restructuring efforts in that regard, working with the Department of Ed. We know even with our major renovations, we still have some facility challenges. Our mechanical and HVAC was not upgraded. It's dated, it's old, and we have continual problems with some of that infrastructure. We have sections of our roofs that we were not able to upgrade, and they will be aging. Our bleachers in our gym are about ready to call it a day. They need to be replaced. We have a territorial school where the alternative school was housed up until a couple of years ago. It has some substantial needs over there for reconstruction. Staff recruitment and retention. As I mentioned, we are off the road. I will basically fly in, fly out over. You know, one of the things that really impacts our staff here is just the distance to friends and family. It's not easy to get out of Dillingham with the weather patterns that we have on any given day, probably from November through spring. You never know if you're getting out in the morning and coming back in the night. And it's expensive to fly even out of here, even to Anchorage. It's roughly $490 a round trip ticket, and add that if you're going to the lower 48 or anywhere else. The cost of living, rent is high out here, housing is high out here, energy costs are high out here. You know, all the staples of life, your gas, food, clothing, you name it. It has a premium because it's either air freighted in here or barged in here, and it's not inexpensive, and our teachers, when they come in, do a great job, but I know they have economic challenges staying in the area due to these factors. Restructuring some of the things that we have done in the last couple of years. We're seeking to implement a research-based strategy, emphasis on that. One of the things we did not have a couple of years ago were any reading intervention specialists, content experts that really need to get in there, roll up their sleeves, and work with those lower performing kids, because they need that if they're going to make progress. We've added 2 intervention specialists to that K-3. We've added 1 to 3-5. We've added 1 to the secondary. And I think that's a big part of that third grade achievement score last year. Through our RTI program, our response to intervention, we've really seen a dramatic improvement in the steady progress of the kids. We run an extended day for our high school kids. We've expanded from a 6th to a 7th period day for selected students, and extended the contract day for 3 teachers to assist those kids at the secondary level to help them with their classwork, to help them on skill building, to help them with credit recovery that they need. Our after-school tutorial program that we started, we partnered with the local agency, SAFE, and we have what they call a Can-Do grant. We've hired a success liaison through that grant. We hired 1/2 of our interventionists at the high school through that grant. We've hired peer tutoring. We have kids helping kids over at SAFE. They've renovated an evening location for the kids in the community that they can go over to the SAFE program and have peer-to-peer tutoring and adults over there to help them. Our success liaison makes home contacts and is charged with improving our connection with our local community to improve that, and of course the intervention teachers that I mentioned. Continuing with the restructuring, we joined voluntarily the STEP program with Deed last year, did a school-wide assessment of where we're at, what we're doing, how we're doing it, how can we make improvements. We had multiple committees with staff and community members and school board members, and through that process we identified a number of goals and objectives for our school district that we're going to continue to work on. One of the major things that we did, and we found that our curriculum just wasn't in alignment with the Alaska standards. We went through a year-long process with that, and all of our curriculum, K-12 now, in the content area, is aligned with the Alaska standards. We've implemented a positive behavior intervention support program to ensure that we have good cooperation, safe school, good conduct, and so the teachers don't have to be fighting discipline issues in the classroom as well as academic issues. We've had very good success with this program, and it's been in place for a number of years at the elementary school, and we fully integrated it into the high school, secondary school this year. We're strengthening our career technical programs at the secondary level. We have plans that we would like to progress and restructure there into a career technical, career pathway type school with three major areas of emphasis. Keep the strong core academics, keep the high rigor, keep the ability for kids not only to get good career technical training, but also solid academic training so that they can go post-secondary if they desire. They go right into the trade. They can go to a career technical post-secondary school. And so we're just beginning that adventure here, but we're very positive in our thinking on where we can go with that. Drop-off prevention program. You know, we know we have a serious drop-off problem here in our area, and we need to make some efforts on this more than what was done in the past. And as a result, we put this program in place. And we're really looking at a number of factors. We monitor this daily. We do weekly checks. Our success liaison, our counselor, our administrative staff, and our drop-off prevention team all have worked to implement this program. We're looking at attendance, academic achievement, classroom conduct, credit recovery, and our success liaison. And we just started this program this year. Our graduation rate over a period of years, and I'm going to just show you that slide. You can see what's happening with our graduation rate. It has went from a low in FY04 of 13% to a high in 09-10 to 70%. At that point, we thought we had a very positive trend line, and we're going up from there. But we had a significant drop last year, and that really prompted us to kick this drop-off prevention program into full gear, because we really had to get in and take those cohorts apart and see what was going on, because that definitely wasn't acceptable to us. You can see our dropout rate has kind of been right around that 10%, 8 to 10% range for the last FY04 through FY10. So we know that's a definite challenge for us out here. We're looking at what we can do about it, and that drop-off prevention program slide is key to that. And, of course, it's beautiful out here. There's no doubt about that. And as everybody in the state of Alaska knows, if you like fishing, this is the place to come. And kind of concluding my comments, it's essential for us, folks, that we get an increase in that BSA, or we are really going to be in a fiscal hurt out here. You know, we have the range of things that have been thrown out there from the Laswell study with D of $320 necessary to maintain the educational programs across the state. I know that SB 171 is on the table. That certainly would help. So it looks like we're somewhere in between there. Our health insurance, we did not expect a jump like this. This is really a challenge for us. A small district like ours to have to look at making up a $240,000 increase is significant. Also, the energy support we got last year was one-year funding, so that's $93,000 out of the budget. So now we're looking at $330,000 deficit before we even do anything with the dropping enrollment that potentially can add another negative $13,000 per kid, and that's going to impact our school improvement initiatives, our reading intervention content experts. They're all first-year teachers out here, and you all know that generally if there's risks, it affects those non-tenured type staff. So without any increase, it's going to be very difficult for us to continue the improvements that we're seeing. So I want to thank you guys for allowing me to opportunity, and I wish we could have been on Skype, but maybe it'll work for the next person up. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Superintendent. There are several questions here, but I have a question. In terms of the dropout rate, I know sometimes there's students drop out. They drop out for many reasons. Is there any particular reason that that you would say is totally out of your control? We want those things that we can address, we need to, and those things that we can't address, we need to acknowledge, so you're not taking a hit on that. Are there any aspects of the dropout rate that you feel like is totally out of your control?
Well, there are some. You know, we have community issues out here. You folks are all probably pretty aware of some of the statistics for the area. You know, we have high unemployment rate. We have substance abuse issues in the community. You know, we have family issues within the community. And when kids are going through struggles at home and maybe they don't have the best home situation, or maybe there's drug and alcohol issues in the family, if there's economic issues that challenge them, these things we have very little control over. And they are difficult, and they do impact our kids. I mean, we see it all the time, and unfortunately it's a challenge for the community, and the community is working on it, but it's a reality. You know, we are 70% Native Alaskan, and the issues that are challenges for our local population statewide are here too. So those are some of the factors that are difficult for us to control. Also distance, you know, we're spread out. We basically bus all the kids in. Weather conditions, you know, if it's a bad road day, any given day, even if we run our buses partially, you know, it's difficult for the kids to get to school sometimes, and that impacts our attendance rate. So those are some of the variables that are out there that we don't have a lot of control over.
Thank you. Representative Sissina, then Representative Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Superintendent Cloud, I had the great privilege of getting to your community 2006, and 2006, and I did get over to the school, and what, 150, somewhere in there, population dropped since that time, is I think what I saw, and at the time was absolutely entranced with the area and the many different activities that were occurring, and the neat road to Aleknikik, and being able to fly over to Naknek and King Salmon, and those potential tourist areas that actually are developing, at least they were then, and I hear of people going that way, and then we had a legislative health caucus on education in school, and the information we got from Dillingham of the school lunch program and the local fishermen helping supply the fish for the lunch and the bike program. Now, are those programs still going? Because it was obvious that really your school was ahead of the curve and really working on trying to make absolutely positive that that kids in the school were being given a really better than even break. And then a little question to add at the end of this, because sometimes it's hard to get all these pieces in, but you talk about the challenges of the community itself, and what's really ironic is that immediately right now the Legislative Finance Subcommittee on Health and Social Services is looking at children's services right now. And we have over 2,000 kids in foster care. And as you were going through the challenges in the community and how that will affect your school, and added on to the question about how you're doing in terms of helping the kids have the skill sets to really develop your own community, if you could talk about if you're losing kids by any chance to foster care or family breakup or that kind of stuff. I'd really like to know. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah, you've touched on a number of things. The Fish for Kids program is a wonderful program. It's a wonderful partnership between the Peter Pan cannery here and the commercial fishing industry. We are continuing that program. We do it annually. Every Friday, we serve that delicious salmon in a variety of ways to the kids, very healthy. And so our food service program is continuing that program, and we're very appreciative of that effort. It's a very nice partnering effort. Along with Children's Services, I know that the various BBs out here, Bristol Bay Native Association, Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, BBNA, Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and the BBAHC, the Health Corporation, we have a very good partnering with them, and they actually are expanding child services. We have a school psychologist now through the hospital that comes in once a week to assist some of our more challenged kids in that area. We're very appreciative of that. The local social service agencies are working very hard on a number of fronts for the welfare of the community. The CANDO program I mentioned earlier is an example of that. It's a district, community-wide partnership, if you would, of which we participate in most of those BBs I mentioned, as well as other entities, to address issues in the community that impact us. And so those are all sustaining themselves. We probably see more kids coming to us in placement for foster care than we do going out. In my short tenure here, I haven't seen any of the kids here needing to be placed in foster care outside of the community. I have seen a number of students statewide be placed here with some of our foster care families that have come into the school system.
Okay, and because, technology glitches really did set us behind the schedule here, so if we could just kind of be concise with our questions and answers. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Superintendent McLeod, one of the things that we as a committee have been really looking into, and we've gotten various degrees of how any of the communities that are in that level five area and the state or the department has come in and helped. How has your experience been working with the department? Has it been upsetting? Has it been good? Where are you at with that?
I feel we have a very good relationship with the department. Although we're level five, we're not a very, very low scoring school. We just push the limits on not making the AYP measurement. So we have substantial gains and improvement. We're just not getting to the AYP, and the department has recognized that, and they've been very good in working with us and listening to what we want to do for restructuring and allowing us to progress in that. And when we went through the step process, when we did have questions or issues or problems that we noticed, they were very collaborative in working with us. So I have no problems with the Department of Education. They've been very supportive of our efforts out here, and they've worked with us in a collegial and friendly manner.
Great. One more question, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman. How do you feel, has it helped? You said you have the curriculum alignment with the state standards now. Do you think that's helped? Or have you still been able to work in relevancy with the surrounding area and how the natives respond to this curriculum? How do you feel that's going?
I feel it's going positively. Our problem was most of the curriculum we had was dated and had been looked at for a number of years. And getting it in alignment with the Alaska standards has helped our teachers focus on those. They do a lot of hands-on type things in the classroom. One example I'll give you is when we had the orca whales out here that unfortunately got caught up in Nooshiak and wound up dying. And they were brought into Dillingham, and our science classes went down there to view and participated in the necropathy that happened and working with the local scientists and trying to determine what happened to those orcas. And we take advantage whenever possible when we have an opportunity of our local environment and our hands-on and weaving things into our from our culture into our classes.
Great. Thank you very much.
Representative Feige, then Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McLeod, since 2006, have you eliminated any teacher positions?
In 2006, I wasn't here. I came last year. This is my second year. In my tenure here, I have not, but I know that they did previous to that. They had annual decreases in budgets. There was annual rifts. People were let go. Last year, we had a very good fiscal year, if you would. The enrollment actually came in a little above where it was anticipated, and so we weren't challenged last year fiscally as they had been in the past. I may not be able to say that after this year. As we go into next year, we definitely have some fiscal challenges.
Thank you. Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In terms of the, since the student counts generate the basically generate the amount of aid that you receive, is there any advantage to moving the timing of those student counts to give you more certainty from year to year? In other words, if... Go ahead.
No. I've watched different counts at different times over time, and you can move that count just about anywhere, and there's an advantage or disadvantage to it. I personally feel the end of October count is a good point to keep it. You need a point in time that's constant, because some communities might continue to increase in enrollments. Most communities tend to decrease in enrollment after that October count. Historically, with most states and most, when they set that count date, it's usually in the fall, because that tends to be your highest enrollment period, unless you're in a community that's just experiencing a lot of growth, and of course then you would continue to increase. So I think it's set about right where it is, and I'm not an advocate for changing it.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki, and then we do need to move on.
Sure. Just really briefly, thank you, Superintendent. On the graph on page 9, I think it is, on the challenges, it talks about the graduation rate. In FY04, you said it was 13%. Seemed pretty low. Can you tell me if it was like that prior to those years? And then what accounts for the increase in graduation rates between FY04 and 05?
Yeah, I believe the state probably, that's as far back as I could go and get historical data, was 2004. I don't have any other historical data that I can find in the files or at deed on graduation rates. And that may have been when this accountability factor was put in. And I can't really speak to why that was so low then, other than it's a very low figure. I know the community at that time was very concerned about it, and many efforts kicked into gear, and it may have been just an anomaly that year that was so low, because when you look at the rest of the years, you know, they range from that 38% of last year, and it bounces, but it's never went back to that kind of a low, so I'm not really sure what happened there.
Okay, quick follow-up.
Great. Actually, just one more on the second page, challenges dealing with the fiscal situation. You know, this committee will probably hear a bill, or finance committee will hear a bill very soon relating to the BSA. And I'm just curious what the thoughts are. One thought is to increase the BSA over the next 3 years at a fixed amount. That's what the Senate proposes. The governor sounds like he's not interested in increasing the BSA, but rather doing one-time funding like the energy funding. And I'm just curious what impacts that would have on your school district.
Well, if we do not get any BSA increase, we will have a shortfall, and we will be reducing staff. That's a given. And you've heard that from the larger districts also. We're just a smaller scale of that. I think the governor is short-sighted and advocating a one-time increase. Certainly any increase will help us, but that's a stopgap. It's a Band-Aid. It helps for 1 year. The thing that drives the economics of a school district is what's in that BSA formula, because so much of the costs are taken out of that. And if we don't have the ability to forecast a year or two or three down the road, it's extremely difficult to determine how you're going to manage your resources. We have to build on a flat budget right now. When I do that scenario, I know that I'm going to have around a $400,000 shortfall. In a small district, that's people. I can't find that much money in my budget on the other areas there. I've also ran a scenario where if we went with SB 171, where it's 125, 130, 135, I can substantially manage the fiscal resources and make the cuts I need to, probably without impacting staff with even that increase. So from my perspective, it's extremely important for the school districts to get this forward funding and have some increases there. I mean, you can't expect us to run the schools on the same amount of money when you and I both know that there's increases there. And I don't buy this argument that the schools are failing all over the place. Our school district is not failing. We can show you the statistics in the areas that we put focus, and we're making progress. And without funding in the BSA and forward funding, that is going to negatively affect that.
Okay. Thank you, Superintendent. We really appreciate your time and insight. And I know Dillingham is a beautiful place, especially around the Lechnicket. Thank you, sir. Okay, next we have a testimony. We were not able to get in on the first hearing, HB 256, and testimony is by today is by invitation only. And thank you for your patience. Commissioner Hanley, I appreciate your being willing to come back on the second day. And please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. And I would like to give you an assurance, sir, that if I'm advocating a collaborative model, I certainly need to be collaborative. So, when all this is said and done, I promise you that you will have you'll be able to respond to any of the testimony. You might not get the last word, but I promise you the second to last word. All right.
Thank you, Representative Dick. And members of the House Education Committee, I appreciate this opportunity to testify in regards to strategies that the department has used in interventions around the state. When I took this role a year ago, I recognized the responsibility to the public trust that this position holds. I appreciate the comments I've heard previously that, well, he's not a bad guy, but I also, along with that, recognize that I've never defined leadership as a function of authority, but rather as a function of responsibility. And so since February 2nd of last year, the department has been led by me, and I have a responsibility to be able to look the public and to look you in the eye for the decisions that have been made in regards to the intervention status of our districts. So I hope we aren't picturing the department as an inanimate machine that can't be steered. I take responsibility for the decisions and the actions that have been made. They've been thoughtful, they've been stressing, but they've been done with our kids in mind. And so I hope to at least express some of that today and answer the questions that I know you'll have in regards to that. We have three primary beneficiaries that drive what we do in the department, and they are the students, the schools, and the educators. That's what focuses our mission in the Department of Education. Now, sometimes it seems like the Moore case has been termed as a kind of a synonymous version of intervention, and it really is something very different. They are connected, but they are different. The one thing that the Moore case has done, when the plaintiffs first filed that, they said the state of Alaska is not doing their job providing their constitutional obligation to our kids for education because they're not providing the funding to adequately educate our kids. And that was the premise of the original portion of the Moore case. And I won't spend all my time on the Moore case, but what came out of that is that Judge Gleason in the Superior Court defined our responsibility, our constitutional responsibility as a state to our kids. And it is to establish and maintain That's what's written in the Constitution. She defined that in four prongs. She said, you need to have a set of standards that the kids can aim for. It's your goal. You need to have a way to assess the children in regards to those standards to see if they're moving in the right direction. Are they moving towards the goal? You need to provide adequate funding, and you need to provide adequate accountability and oversight. And she said many times that the state has adequate standards, has adequate assessments, has funded education adequately, but they have failed in regards to their accountability and oversight. And she says that very distinctly and clearly, and she reprimands the state for a state that believes strongly in local control, and we do. We believe that those decisions on how to teach children can best be made by the people there in those communities. It would be erroneous for me, from Anchorage or from Juneau, to try to tell Bill McLeod the best way to teach his kids. We'll set the standards. Bill McLeod and other superintendents and the school boards will say, how do we get there? Let's find the most relevant way to connect our kids to that knowledge and get them in that direction. So what I'd like to do now is, the slides I've got are just, they're just to guide this conversation, but I'm going to jump quickly because the conversation has largely been revolving around the Upiat School District. And the Upiat School District is not synonymous with intervention either. We've had five. Upiat School District is one. Let me just jump quickly to this slide, and it is towards the end of your packet. There's, I think, three or four slides in regards to student data. Now, these are, the top line there is from 2005 to 2010. I didn't have the 2011 on there. There was a slight trend downward in all of those lines in 11. But the bottom line there is the Upiat School District. And if we were to look, and those are the other school districts above it that have been or are still our intervention districts. Upiat School District, this is SBA reading, has been hovering in the 25% range. 25% of the kids are proficient in reading. Looking at the math data, it was 9% when we intervened in 2005. It is now in the 20s. And it's been, you can see it's been kind of hovering there in the 20. One out of five children is proficient in those scores. Now, the SBA data, this graph basically shows where do children stand in regards to a line of proficiency, a line in the sand that says you're either above it or you're below it. You're either proficient or you're not. Now, it doesn't paint the rest of the picture, and there is much more to the picture. This is MAP data. It's new data, formative data that districts use. Our trustee helped acquire these materials for the Upiat School District. They chose to use them. If you look at the third grade MAP data, and it shows both reading and math, 77% in third grade of our kids in reading are in the first to 10th percentile. And it's a dismal, it's a scary picture. It's a picture that breaks my heart when I see where the kids are there. Now, what it doesn't show here is that within that first to 10th percentile, 80% of that blue line is in the 1 to 2 percentile. So we have a significant number of our children that are not proficient, they're not even close. We hopefully will begin to move these kids forward. But even as we move them forward, you won't necessarily see that show up on that other graph because they're so far below that proficiency line that our goal is to move them up. I do have some data in regards to that. And we are seeing some growth. Growth in those, I'll find it. I got it. We do see growth in those below proficient areas. This last year, we had in language and arts, which is the reading, we had 38 of our kids, or 19.8% of our kids, showed proficient. But the more important thing is we showed that 20 of those kids that were below proficient made a year and a quarter's worth of growth or more. Now, they won't show up on your proficiency score, but we are starting to make a difference moving these kids forwards. And I say we. It'd be erroneous for me to say that the state is doing that. You know, I say we as the school district is making those changes. You know, we are, you know, we're there helping and assisting, providing the coaches, but, you know, it is not the state that is making these difference. But we are, I want to paint a picture for you that although this looks dismal, we are seeing our kids move forward, even though they may not show up on the proficiency scores yet. A couple of other things we have seen. In 2007, when the judge in the Moore case said that the state is not doing enough as far as their oversight goes, we have the HSGQE, the High School Graduation Qualifying Exam, and it is based on 8th, 9th, and 10th grade standards. And it's just a basic competency assessment. It's a different conversation whether we like that or not, but it is that one tool that you need to pass that before you graduate. The judge at that point said these children in the UPIT district are not even being taught or exposed to 8th, 9th, and 10th grade material. So you cannot use the HSGQE to withhold a diploma from them. So they didn't even have that curriculum. They weren't even shown it. We weren't giving them the response, the obligation, or the opportunity to learn it, so we couldn't test them on it. So we had to remove that qualifying exam for a while. We now have an aligned curriculum. We now have that curriculum back in place, and our children are taking the HSGQE. The UPIT district in particular has done some great things in regards to some remediation plans and really working hard to get those kids to pass that test. So there are some things that have been done that don't necessarily show up on graphs. Backing up to the third slide, which was right after that, the one I previously showed in regards to the four prongs. The judge said, for the state to fail to take a considerably more directive role in the face of chronically poor performance, at least for the children in UPIT, amounts to an impermissible legislative abdication of the state's constitutional responsibility to maintain public schools in this state. And I will tell you that we have been slow, the state, the department, we have been slow to react to the needs of our children. I have a harder time looking people in the eye and explaining why we've taken so long to offer the assistance and oversight than I do for what we have done. When we look at needs for intervention, there are strategies that we use. The primary strategy that is used are content coaches. That's the one tool that we have used in all five districts. Content coaches go in, they work directly with teachers and principals to build capacity of those teachers to help them make sure that they're connected to each other from grade to grade, that children are learning in a continuous line towards the standards, help them with best practices. That's the primary tool that we use. I heard Howard Diamond, he's asked me specifically, I heard him allude to it previously, that they're only there a week out of the month. You know, and with flying time, sometimes it's only 3 or 4 days. We need them there more. So as a primary tool, there's at least a recognition of the need for those coaches on the ground more. I've got a very short letter that there was a principal at Tulixac last year, which typically had been the lowest of the three schools in the UPIT district. And I'll read this. It'll just take a moment. I think a lot of people want me to say that state intervention teams and assistance didn't help, but that's not true. They did help. They were able to help us when we were short in manpower, short with necessary ideas, and they were able to provide the necessary leadership in critical areas like reading, leadership, organizational skills, and state-needed requirements. Now, I cannot speak for the other schools or speak for the districts and the state's help in those areas. All I can do is speak about Tulixac. Molly, she is one of our primary coaches. Molly and her crew were able to provide some support, advice, and a lot of necessary skills that we at the time needed. It was and is a good relationship for us to have them in our building. After a while, they were just a part of the school and the staff, and they were almost a part of the community. The kids knew them, the staff welcomed them, and our facilities were open to them. It was easy to have them here, and it was easy to have them assist us. I would dare say that there was a significant level of trust between both our organizations. So as I mentioned, the state team helped. It worked for us. Thank you for your help. And this is from Lance Jackson, who just retired from Tuxedo, is now living down the States. To me, that is my goal. That's our goal in intervention, is to step forward with support that builds capacity and has this kind of reaction. We know it's not the case all over the place. I also recognize that whenever the state or an outside entity comes in, there's a potential for friction. The decisions that I've continued to make focus back, but what do we need to do for our kids? The other thing that we provided as strategies, technical assistance, we provide grant writing help, curriculum alignment, and development. For those of you that are in the House Subfinance Committee, we spoke about a science curriculum that we helped develop with Yukon Flats. Yukon Flats is also one of our intervention districts. They did not have a science curriculum, period. They did not have a system that they taught their kids any science. So we told them, we said, you know, as a state, we said, you have to have a science curriculum. Your kids are owed a science curriculum. And they said, so what do you want us to do? Do you want us to buy one? What do you want us to do? They came back later and said, this is what we'd like to do. We'd like to have something that's relevant. We'd like to have something that will work in our community. And we had some grant monies at that time. We helped them develop that. We actually wrote a lot of that for them, and they now have that science curriculum that they use and is available for other districts as well. So we provide that technical assistance and that curriculum support as well. We also provide professional development training. Our last year, our biggest one was we did a literacy institute in Anchorage, and we invited all the staff. We actually provided stipends and paid for the cost for pre-literacy, like the Head Start programs, as well as the early literacy programs in our intervention districts, brought them to Anchorage for a week-long institute. So we really, really connected the two. Sometimes they're disconnected, this pre-literacy, the preschool, a Head Start in the schools. We brought them all together to help focus on the skills that our kids need. And we do have, as you know, in one district, we have a trustee, and that person is in the UPS School District. He provides oversight in regards to, they have a SIG grant that we also helped with. It's a $500,000 per school per year grant that we were able to help them write with federal funding. So they have $1.5 million per year for 3 years. He helps make sure that we meet the obligations for that the district meets the obligations, as well as their district improvement plan that we're continuing to focus on teaching with fidelity the reading curriculum and the math curriculum to help our kids move up that continuum. It may be overkill, but I'll say this, I'll read this, and this is one place where I feel like the state was severely reprimanded for their lack of action. Again, this is 2007. The Superior Court has had subsequent decisions in 9 and 10 that basically refer back to 2007. But I'm a visual person, so I put it on this slide, and I'll read it quickly. Even at schools in which student performance has been extremely poor and has shown no improvement for many years, the state has failed to provide an adequate oversight role with respect to either the considerable state funds that it disperses or with respect to the delivery of the instruction to the children in those schools. In short, the state has failed to take meaningful action to maximize the likelihood that the children in these troubled schools are accorded an adequate opportunity to acquire proficiency in the state standards when a school has demonstrated an unwillingness or inability to correct the situation on its own. All I can say is that we have not been as proactive as we should be. We have been very reactive. And part of the reason there is a trustee in the UPIA district is because the UPIA district was mentioned many, many times, specifically the UPIA district, by the Superior Court, and saying you have to step in and you have to do more. You have to take a more directive role there for the kids' sake. So is it the correct model? It's hard to picture a trustee stepping into a district without some sense of angst, without some sense of, you know, I would picture it like an auditor coming into the office and saying, you know, I'm going to look over your books. It's difficult. I understand that. I look back to what do we owe our kids. And I guess the point of me speaking to this and how we've done our work to date is that I've heard it said, and I think it was mentioned in previous testimony, that we've used a hammer, that that's it, that's all we've used. And I don't see our coaches as a hammer. Howard Diamond has asked for us to have them out there longer. I don't think technical assistance is a hammer. I understand that the trustee can be considered a hammer, but the trustee does not give directions to the district. He offers suggestions. And I've got the, and we can, if there are questions about that, the order appointing the trustee and his role and responsibilities, I've got that as well. So I'm sure there are a lot of questions, but with that, I wanted to give you some oversight of the decisions that we have made. And part of the decision that I've had a lot of conversations with Howard Diamond, and it is his opinion that the trustee should be gone. And I wrestle with that, and I've wrestled with him with that, and said, I understand that. Okay, how do we make this happen? How do we get the trustee from the UPS School District when the judge has said over and over again, you better go in there, and you better make, you know, you better provide more direction? So I've got two directions there. And we are working on a plan and an exit strategy for that trustee. I'm doing that directly with Howard Diamond. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a point of clarification. Thank you, Commissioner. I don't think there's any question that the test scores in Upiat School District are low. There's no question about that. And it is a question of how the help comes to that district. And there does seem to be a little bit of confusion in terms of, I guess, nobody's speaking about taking away the help that could come to a district. The question is, how does that help come? And you heard from Howard Diamond, you'll hear from Kim Langdon, you'll hear from Dr. Norm Eck. So nobody's out there saying we don't want any help. What people are saying is we really do want help, but we need it in a way that is collaborative, cooperative. And so I wanted to clarify that issue. Nobody's saying we got it all figured out, we don't need you. Nobody's saying that at all. Representative Cisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My question is that huge problem. Just obviously, just as big as you can get, and it actually goes throughout state government. It's just not in the Department of Education. It's throughout state government, and it's actually, we've got two different worlds that exist in the same boundaries, and one's urban, one's rural. And it's really hard for people to understand that in a subsistence world, you're talking about a culture that's very old, that it's been there in place and kept people alive. And in those places, those populations are dropping. So something's not working there, for sure. We're here. We want what we believe is good to be here. But the only way that we're going to solve this problem is to think differently than we were thinking when the problem got started. Well, I mean, it's been building in a lot of ways. So in all of this process, and I've heard your explanation, and I get into the same boat myself sometimes when I'm screwing up big time, is not looking at it the same way we did look at it. And I think one of the ways that I think is really good is to go back and try to figure out what were the lessons we learned. And I haven't heard that in your presentation. I didn't learn what you've learned. And this has been day by day in the last couple of weeks even. I mean, there's been learning that's being done right this minute. Obviously something, and I've talked to people in the Yukon Flats and in the Koyukuk School District just recently to kind of get some feeling about what other places I've been to kind of have experienced. And it's not one-sided. There's two sides on this, and there's lots of material on both sides. And that's, so right now, what you guys have got to do, because you're the ones who've been given this task, is learn new ways of looking at this. So could you tell us what maybe your lessons have been?
Glad to through the chair, Representative Cisna. I've recognized early on the value of culture. You know, we have our cultural standards that are incorporated into our academic standards. I also recognize that the best decisions can be made at the local level, and I truly value that local decision-making ability. That's specifically why the state's responsibility, or the state's, I'll say responsibility, basically stops at the development of the standards and assessments there. We think that those standards are tools that the children can use to be successful in their own communities as well as anywhere else they choose to go. One thing, and I had conversations with the OSSOG group, which is a student government group from around the state, mostly rural students, and I asked them in small groups, I said, so what does education owe you? What do you want out of this? And I did this five different groups, and they said, basically, well, a lot of them said money, but a lot of them also said, I want to be able to get a job. And I said, okay, so you want to be able to get a job in your community when you're done? He said, no, I want to be able to get a job anywhere I go. And so that was profound for me, to hear students say, no matter where I choose to work, I want to be able to get a job. I want to have the skills I need to get a job there. And I think we have a responsibility as a state to make sure they have those basic skills to keep all of their doors open, no matter where they choose to live. Now, that is not to suggest that I want them to leave. But a child that has those skills, a student that graduates with those skills, will be a tremendous asset for that community as well. They'll be the ones that will have the job that can afford the exorbitant price of gas and the exorbitant price of milk. The state sets the what. We set the standard, and we allow the districts, and you heard Bill McLeod speaking to how they set the how. You know, the Wales came in. We use that. You know, we're setting the how to get there, how to acquire the skills, how to connect our kids. Representative Dick and I both went up to Barrow. Tremendous theme-based education taking place up there. You know, they're studying density, and they're using whale meat and whale blubber. Very powerful. They set the how. That's where the power is. We just kind of set the goals that allow them that what we see to be successful in and out of their communities.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my 12th year, and I've seen when I first came, many of the problems haven't changed overall. I'm thinking of suicide, domestic abuse, statewide, you know. And I'm thinking how when we would try to go in and what we perceived as helping, they didn't want our help. They didn't, I mean, lots of times an outsider just isn't welcome. So I have no idea if that's changed or not. I know in the past it might be starting to get a little bit better. So I know that you have that a little bit to deal with. Is it possible with the trustee that whole setup can be changed just a little so there's a little more communication between the trustee and the school? I think when the trustees would say, well, no, I'm not supposed to help you, I'm just supposed to be here to observe, that's, you know, then they feel like it's a policeman there, you know. So I don't know if that can be changed a little bit. I'm just trying to think of ways to help so that relationship and that they don't feel like it's the Gestapo that's there or something, kind of watching what they're doing. And so maybe a change to a different trustee at this point, maybe it's the personality. I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to think of ways that maybe I realize that, and I think you're right. I do think you're right that the courts have said this is what we have to do, and it's obvious that it needed to be done. Now, if we need to maybe do it a little bit differently, you know, I think that's probably what we're hearing just a little bit, but some of the things are obviously working well. So I have one other question.
Quick follow-up.
Is the science curriculum that you helped them with, has that been passed out to other schools?
It's available. I don't know how many other school districts are utilizing it right now.
Okay. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here, Commissioner. So you've been on the job now for 1 year and a couple days, and I know we've heard this bill at least once or twice in briefing, and this is the first chance that you've actually had an opportunity to respond. The sponsor of the bill and at least one other school district had said that the department has not worked collaboratively and has violated the spirit and intent of SB 285. The member from the Bethel region, who snuck in right behind you, said that there is perhaps an institutional bias against Western Alaska. These are claims that I wish we had the opportunity to hear from you right away, but can you just address those two of the most, I mean, the largest of the claims, I think?
Absolutely. The first one being in regards to collaboration.
Collaboration.
I can speak to, I've read the things about the collaboration that we've had with our coaches. I spoke with Carrie Boyd. She feels like we were very collaborative in the Yukon-Koyukuk district. Obviously, there's friction in the Upiat district, but there has been support for the coaches. It seems that the concern is around the trustee. The trustee has helped in several ways. He has not directed them to do anything, but he has helped provide the materials. And I'm going to say this not to give credit to the trustee. That's not my goal. It's to give you an example of where I believe he's collaborating. Maybe not to the extent that's necessary, but that he's collaborating. He has helped with the SIG grants, which was that federal funding grant. He helped and acquired, got the materials. He contacted Northwest Education Association to get them the MAPS data, allow them to make the decision on whether they want to use it or not. He had some insight into principal hiring last year, and he sat in on some of the interviews. He actually spoke to Howard, gave some insight when he thought it was appropriate. Howard actually listened and said, you know, that's probably a good idea on this one individual, and they hired someone else. So I think there have been times when he's collaborative. At the end of every visit that he's out there, he sits down with the superintendent as well and gives him his thoughts from the different schools. He says, here's what I'm seeing. This looks good. You know, might want to keep an eye on this. He does not tell Howard what to do. In regards to the bias of towards Western Alaska, the process in SB 285 is very clear that the state must have a system of identifying low-performing schools and how they'll step in. And although I'm not going to go over it, I did bring the ones we have used this year. And it's a set of data that is very specific on how we do it. They're called 872 schools. And it's in regards to Regulation 06872. And they are schools that show up low on this growth model. Students are not moving in the right direction. Not SBAs, not AYP and CLB things. It is, are they moving in the right direction? So if they're not, they'll show up. We'll do a little further review and say, okay, how's the graduation rate? How's the attendance rate? Things like that. And we'll do a desk audit. Just look over information. From there, if there are still concerns, we'll do an instructional audit. And this represents about 40 phone calls and the notes that came with them and the questions that were asked and then recommendations. You know, is there something we should do as a state? Should we let this go? You know, where do we need to intervene? From there, schools are put into different categories on where we need to keep an eye on them. So we've got here's districts with 872 schools. We really don't do anything with them. Here's ones targeted. We're just keeping an eye on, see if they need support. What can we do? Tier 3, those are the ones with intervention. We work with them in their STEP plans, their school plans on making sure everything's adequate and they have aligned curriculum and things like that. The STEP plans are in the back. It's very deliberate process. And the only reason I show you that is because I've heard that somehow UPO was picked, you know, because of an inappropriate reason. And this is where my responsibility to you, I need to be able to look you in the eye and say, UPA is a very low-performing district. We do this in a very deliberate way based on what was in SB 285. I could easily sit down and quantify our decisions and show you the data on why we are where we are.
Follow-up on that.
Quick follow-up.
another part or another reason for the sponsor to introduce this bill is that it seems that every school might be on the path to an intervention, and that the department does not have a, or only has a subjective process in which to intervene. So can you address that comment? Is it a subjective process internal to the department in picking intervention districts, or is there an actual, I mean, I think you might have said it, is there an actual matrix which you go through? Because, I mean, just from Fairbanks' standpoint, I don't think that we want to be called an intervention district. I don't think we want the state to intervene in our case. So can you address that question?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. I think I did, you know, it was my attempt to address that with the process that we have in place for how to intervene. AYP, Adequate Yearly Progress, based on the No Child Left Behind law, is not the tool we use, because we recognize that 2014, we have to be at 100%. The representative said that. It's not a compliance issue, but we will have been deemed. This coming year, I would anticipate that 85% of our schools will have been considered failures using the tool of No Child Left Behind. It's an erroneous tool. It's not one that we will use. SB 285 also requires that the department notify the legislature if they're going to intervene or if they're going to redirect funds. So there is that collaboration here between the department and the legislature before anything takes place. But it is a very deliberate process, and I could sit down and I could quantify the decisions relatively easily. We may come up with different conclusions based on the data, but I think it'd be pretty. It's not truly subjective based on a lot of data.
One more question on content. Mm-hmm. On the this is a sort of separate question on the content coaches. It was mentioned, I think, both by the superintendent and by yourself, that it's a great help to have them there, but that there's only a few times or a month that they're in. Is that a function of what's that a function of? Is that a process issue where they're just skipping from place to place? Is it a financial issue in which we have not allocated enough money for intervention school districts? Can you explain why there seems, because that was sort of the complaint, was that there should be more input from these content coaches, and they're not seen there as often as they would like in the school district.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it's a function of several things. One is that they are coaches. They're not the players. They are the ones that provide the insight. They're not the ones that are actually doing the work. Mm-hmm. So part of it is, you know, do you really want someone there full time? The coach, they're looking over your shoulder full time. So it's that philosophical model. Although the time out there definitely could be increased. Part of it is a function of contracts and funding. Part of it is the personal abilities of our coaches. It's a tough deal to sleep on the floor of a classroom, which is most commonly the situation, for a week, and making food in the staff lounge and things like that. So I am looking at a slight change to the model. We've intervened in 5 school districts. Maybe looking at some of our low-performing schools. There are some individual schools that are more low-performing than some of the schools in the Olympia district. Is there a way that we can offer support and coaches to them without saying we need to go into a whole district? That may be a more efficient and effective model, and that will become an amount of funding, of how much can we get in there. There are definitely a lot more places we could support.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the Upiat School District, you know, it is a small bit player in this overall scheme, but my initial reaction to that has been that essentially it was a leadership issue on the part of whoever was down there trying to execute the intervention strategy. It's kind of like eating spaghetti. It's a lot easier to draw it in than to try to push it in your mouth. You have to lead it to where you want it to go. And to do that, you have to have a certain amount of street credibility with the audience that you are trying to lead. People think that when you're a leader in the Army, you just tell people and they, hop too. Well,
if you have to resort to that, then you've already failed as a leader. So you're trying to get people to do something, but you have to get their respect first. And apparently, my guess would be that was present in the UPID school district. So how do those intervention specialists, if that's what we can call them, how do they get that street credibility with the people that they are being sent in to intervene on their behalf? And it sort of begs a larger question on the part of the Department of Education is, what kind of people do we have in the Department of Education? What is their experience? From my experience, we have two different educational systems, or two different education environments, if you will. We have a rural and urban, and the logistical challenges for either are significantly different. Howard Diamond has a lot more issues outside the classroom to deal with than, the guy at Romick Middle School or something like that. So what kind of experience do you have in the personnel of the department to deal with those determines, who you can send down into those intervention situations? And that's, I'll leave you to ponder that one, because I would guess that there's probably a lot more urban experience than rural experience in your department. Judge Gleason essentially said the state has to do more. And as you correctly noted, that's sort of in conflict with the whole premise that we allow local districts to have control. I think of a school district as a pyramid management structure. You have school board, you have a superintendent, principals that work for the superintendent, teachers that work for the principals, and so forth. In an intervention situation, is the Department of Education, is it trying to assist from the side, or should it replace the school board at the top of that pyramid? Is there a structural change that needs to happen in the case of an intervention? And is that how the state kind of complies with Judge Gleason's opinion? What are your thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, both in federal law and state law, there sure is that authority to be able to go in and clean house, if you will, to replace school boards, to replace staff, replace superintendents. I don't think anybody, surely not me, and I don't think anybody in the department would ever feel that taking the local control that far out and having to bring in control from outside of a community would have a positive impact. And it goes to the credibility. I feel like I don't see us looking at those models. I just don't think that they're going to be a powerful model. I think that would be a model that would be very destructive to any school district. So we've been dipping our toe in, and maybe not far enough. And how do we go in and help support and build up the administration and the school boards that are there and strengthen them to the sake of the kids?
Excuse me, if I could respond to that a little bit. I asked the same question, what role experience do the people have? My trustee, Sanborn, I believe, is a very skilled educator. I believe his role as a trustee didn't allow him to really respond in a way that he might have had he been superintendent. I asked the commissioner for the background of the coaches, and each one of the coaching teams has someone there with does have a lot of role experience. Some of them have more experience than I do. I really stand in awe of some of the experience. There's others that have no role experience at all. My main concern when I looked at I read through the bios of all the coaches. My concern was that there was, in the whole coaching project, there was never any mention of using or utilizing or demonstrating the cultural standards. And that's the only element that will bring success in the, in the village schools. In terms of the department, I just, my own perception is that I know Commissioner Hanley, I have crossed, we've crossed many, many times, and different, every time we show up, he'll open a in-service and I'll close the in-service. He's out there trying to get the information. But in terms of depth of experience, my perception is that that depth doesn't exist within the department. I know Phyllis Carlson has been in many, many meetings and actually interviewed the UPIT people and said, what do you want? You know, how can we best help this? I read the minutes for the meeting in March of a year or two ago, and the people got back, and we need to integrate the culture into the, you know, the academic process. And the unfortunate part was I didn't see any response to what Phyllis Carlson did find out as she spoke to the intervention district in UPIT. So that's a very, trying to be concise here, answer. So I don't think there's any such thing as having too much experience on, you know, on the ground with the people that are dealing with the issues. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I want to go back just a little bit, and that would be to the experience we had a few years ago where we had the competitive grants to schools, school improvement grants, where we were actually paying merit pay for developing models that worked in all these different schools. And we funded that only for 2 years, I believe, and then dropped it. And so the whole idea of that was to be able to do research on comparative models in similar school districts, whether they're large or small, what was successful. And so I don't think we ever got to that. And so I guess my question is, we've got some very successful rural school districts and very successful rural schools, and we've got some that aren't. And so is the department, instead of just intervening, and are we actually doing research and looking at the differences, what makes those rural school districts successful that are highly successful versus those that, you know, are intervention? Because I want to make sure that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. If we can go in and identify what are the particular things, the differences in those communities and those schools that make one successful and one not. Right.
To the chair, Representative Seaton, we are looking at those things. Just for information, we still use the growth table that was a part of that performance pay model. That is part of how we identify our low-performing schools. It's how our kids are growing along the spectrum. So that's still in place for a different reason, though. We really are not looking at a takeover model or even a testing model. We're looking at a best practices model. What are the best practices? And I think we start fundamentally with making sure that that there's a board adopted curriculum, that they're, you know, that it's aimed in the right direction, that our kids have the opportunity to learn what they need to be successful. But
follow up,
Mr. Chairman. I just want to interrupt because the question that I was asking was not what do we think all schools need,
right,
but are we looking at the schools that have been successful, whether they have those particular items or not, but what are the characteristics that make those rural schools very successful, and then addressing those items in the intervention schools, not just the total panoply of all the things that would improve schools.
To the chair, Representative Seaton, thank you for the clarification. Yes, we know it's not strictly funding. There is a direct connection to community vision, community support, and community expectations in the success of a school. We've got, so that is, it's kind of the one thing that Superintendent McLeod kind of referenced in regards to Rep. Dick's question. There are some things that are hard, that are outside of our control, but we have seen very, very poor, monetarily speaking, a lot of poverty in districts, a lot of social issues, but a real vision for it and expectations for the schools. The teachers come in and the parents say, this is what my kids are better learn this year. This is what, you know, we want from this education. You better get my kid. And we see schools that thrive. There's a neat one down, Ketchmex Elo, as a matter of fact, is one that comes to mind down in the Homer area. A lack of community involvement or vision, and this is not good and bad communities, but a lack of that vision for what they want for their kids has a huge role in the success of the kids and the success of the schools.
Excuse me. I have an apology. Representative Herman's been sitting here for a long time, and I didn't acknowledge his presence, and I should have. Forgive me. I'm just so caught up. Apologize to everyone. Okay. Commissioner, any final thoughts?
Not at this time. Well, I will say just a couple of things. I feel we have a responsibility, moral and legal, to make sure that our kids have an adequate education. The best model, I don't know. I think what we're doing is stepping in the right direction. I think the coaches provide the tools that are going to be a huge asset building capacity. We can strengthen those tools with better cultural training and things like that, but I think it's a good tool. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think we need to continue to look at all the ways that we can make those improvements. I think we need to do more rather than less. I think I'd have a hard time saying we should step back and do less in these districts. I'd have an easier time to look you in the eye and say, boy, we've got to step in and we've got to do more, not just for these districts, but for some of these other schools. And the only other thing I would mention is that in regards to the personality of the trustee, and he's got that experience, he's very credible out there. I have spoken to Howard Diamond about maybe changing trustees, and we have chosen to work on an exit strategy for the trustee to reduce his time out there, not every month, but maybe reduce his time out there instead. So we are working together to find a model that works.
Thank you, Commissioner. Online, I believe we have Kim Langdon. Are you there, Dr. Kim Langdon?
I am here.
Okay, for the record, please identify yourself and give your testimony, sir.
Yes, I'm Dr. Kim Langdon with the Upia School District. Honorable members of the Alaska Education Committee, Commissioner Handley, Superintendent Attic, and others listening in, by way of introduction, my name is Dr. Kim Langdon. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Instruction for the UPIT School District. I also direct the SIG grant that Dr. Hanley has referred to. I served as a principal for 14 years in two Utah districts and a private school in Honduras. I've been superintendent over Iditarod, Cuspah, and Denali Borough School Districts. All schools in Denali made AYP during my tenure there. Several of the schools in Cuspah and Iditarod made AYP and continue today. I was president of SEAC at the time the Moore case was filed. Before the announcement that UPIT School District would be assigned a trustee, I was hired to oversee instruction in the UPIT School District. Much of the conversation today and last week focused on the lack of collaboration and the intervention efforts of DEED. The following points were made. Judge Gleason Moore versus State argued that additional support was needed, particularly in the UPIT School District. She stated that the support be done in a collaborative manner. We heard testimony the state provides experienced, capable content coaches. The plan of support was and is being devised while the plane is in the air. The plan was, is devised in Juneau. Specialists were and continue to be hired and assigned by Juneau, and direction comes from Juneau with minimal YSD input. We believe that DEED had and has the best intent. However, the history of which I am aware and the reality I've experienced in the past year and a half gives a clear indication that the intervention process was implemented with a strong philosophy. The best way to turn around the failing school district was to give mandates, create a plan from afar, discount local efforts, programs, and training, and to superimpose your vision on the district. I remember hearing how intervention schools were being treated by education state when I was elsewhere in the state serving as superintendent and recalling it. Recall finding it hard to believe. Roger Sampson, who I really, really respect, was a commissioner and someone I deeply respected due to his success in Chugach School District, arguably the finest educational system in the state. That district earned its reputation not from top-down efforts, but from a collaboration of bottom-up, top-down, and side-to-side efforts. Time and funding was spent getting people together to study research-proven best practices from wherever they could find them, and all taking responsibility for effective implementation. The result was a turnaround a success that serves students in supporting dynamically increased achievement, preparing students for work and life, preparing them for and helping them get into Job Corps, AvTech, colleges and universities, and overall preparing them for bright futures. I've heard that no child had gone to a university before the turnaround. They're going there now. The changes in the district were made in all aspects of their operation, from the business office to the maintenance program. This resulted in earning the Baldrige Award presented by President Bush in early 2001. From scores of Chugach's folks I've known over the years, this was accomplished through the collaborative involvement of four folks throughout the organization. This should be Alaska's model for a turnaround district. It was and is collaborative, which not only gives insight to its success, but also to its sustainability. Nowhere in the turnaround literature are there examples of state taking over district or intervening in a top-down manner with success. Years ago, the state determined that UKIP scores were low and put it on intervention status. From that time, the staff leadership at UPIC were treated as if they had nothing to bring to the table, little expertise of value to add to discussion, and were left virtually out of the discussion. Perhaps, if Commissioner Sampson had applied his Chugach experience of utilizing trusting and empowering his staff and leadership with intervention districts across the state, we would not be here today, and UPIC would be achieving at far higher levels. The world offers a metaphor. DEET has operated in a manner reminiscent of nation building, where much money is spent, quality expertise is focused, local expertise is ignored, and the results are negative, despite the huge cost. Regarding the content coaches, we have asked these folks, expert folks, come and live with us, serve with us, and truly enable them adequate time to work as coaches with our teachers so that they can have a deep and lasting effect on instruction. Commissioner Ledoux and his deputy replied to our request that we would not be having any, quote, boots on the ground. The hiring of the trustee, especially given the timing, was a wrong support for our teachers, especially given his price tag and the fact that he came, according to him, upon his arrival, simply to observe, not to work with the teachers, not even to work with district leadership in the challenging work of turning around the district. No boots on the ground, despite paying for a trustee with boots on the ground for weeks out of the month. No boots on the ground, despite receiving $7 million from the legislature at the end of the 2010 session earmarked for intervention districts. We would have welcomed that money spent on more time with the coaches to enable them to actually make a difference. The only change we saw after the money was allocated was a trustee sent to observe us. Our principals, curriculum director, and district leadership team are evaluating data, talking to teachers, and observing instruction. We determine together what our needs are. We ask content specialists to work with staff and provide specific support. We often encounter resistance. Our requests unmet. When we fail to collaborate, instruction suffers and students pay the price. If we are to make full use of these content coaches, we need to work collaboratively in how they are directed and utilized. We talk a lot about collaboration. Why is it so important? It obviously is critical for building the kind of professional relationships necessary to be successful. We are told from the business world that we should be teaching children not just to regurgitate material for a test, but to teach them to work collaboratively in groups to solve problems. We certainly should be able to model what we expect our students to do. Beyond that is pragmatically recognizing the value of the experience and expertise of those closest to the children, the culture, and the community where the students live. If you discount the perspective and insights gained there, you will fail. In 2008-09, ACIAC had 40% of its students proficient in the language arts. In 2011, 32% were. In 2007-08, 47% were proficient in math. In 2011, 25% were proficient. ACIAC has remained desperately low in language arts, from 15% proficient in language arts in 2007-08 to 14% in 2011. Academic achievement, while low enough to earn a spot on the intervention list, has gone progressively lower since intervention. Our MAP scores show that over 70% of our students fall in the 1 to 10 percentile in the RIT scores. I do not imply or believe it is the state's fault or all the state's fault. Much of what they have done has value. We all must take responsibility for increasing academic achievement for our students. I spent hours talking about the efforts we were making with the input and direction of our new curriculum director. But the case can and must be made that the top-down intervention process experienced by UPIT has failed. outside of intervention, interactions with the state are very positive in production. The leadership of the current commissioner has given us sincere hope. I personally believe that had Mr. Henley been commissioner at the beginning, it would have been initiated in a much more collaborative and mutually respectful manner. The intent of this testimony is to give statute an objective face that will serve students regardless of personality serving at Deed. This is a situation where simple cooperation would go a long way to better preparing our teachers for the students they serve. The structure of intervention needs to be fixed so the district has a chair or two at the table. We need mutual respect and coordination, which is the same as so much money has been wasted due to poor planning, poor implementation, poor or lacking organization, and an overall top-down philosophy. We could argue forever over strategy, research-proven practices, what should be the plan or vision, etc. But what cannot be argued is a failure of the current effort. It can be fixed, but only if everyone is at the table fairly, equally, working together collaboratively to improve our schools for our kids. It is not so much a question of what, but how. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Langan. Questions from committee? Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One question that I would ask of you, you mentioned a couple things related to the individual that has, the trustee that's been out there. One being, it almost, I want to clarify, does it, would it be satisfactory to you if that trustee spent more time with you guys? And secondarily, if that trustee could in some ways interact more with both the students and with the faculty out there, and would that put some pressure on the community, whether or the school or the teachers there, by having someone from outside coming in and spending more time with you guys and interacting more? Would that kind of give a little bit of a feeling of maybe they're stepping in beyond what they're doing now? Would that put pressure there?
That might. I can tell of a story where one of the board members was observing Mr. The trustee, observing in the hallway, and it came up, what are you doing? And the school board member said, why don't you just get in the classroom, sit down with the kids, and be of value? I've heard from so many teachers that he makes people nervous. He just kind of wanders around the school all day long without much apparent direction or apparent reason for being there. I know that he gives us ideas. He talks to us. He talks to me. He's very cordial. He's very polite. But your question as far as how he could become more a part of the community, a part of the school, being a part of the school, actually getting his hands dirty, if you will, getting involved with the teachers, getting involved with the actual work would be, I think, a plus. We have asked before that he be assigned to different projects that we have in the district, and we have been told by Juno, before Dr. Henley, must say, that we could not ask him to do things for us.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think, okay, I'm trying to get to Dr. Normack. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, many of the comments that we've heard, it always goes back to the beginning and how unhappy people have been. And I hear you saying that in the last year or so that it is better. Do we need to kind of adjust the feeling from what's past is past, and let's see what we can do now?
I feel very strongly regarding, for example, the content specialists, that we really need to, even know what their agenda is when they come, to have input on what that agenda is, and be able to know that if we have legitimate input, requests to be made of certain specialists, that it be followed through on. I don't want to go into any detail, but this has come up very recently, and it has really been a concern, because what we were asking an individual to do, we felt was very important for the teachers. The teachers were asking for it, and it was not done. And a lot of resistance, a lot of excuses. I mean, emails back and forth. it gives me the impression of too many chiefs, and we just need to have a better organization so we have a seat at the table so we can have a say in how these folks are used. But yes, Representative Wilson, it has been much improved working with Commissioner Handley. Very collaborative, very respectful of us, completely different tone, both in action and in word. I guess the biggest concern is that we have a statute that delineates how this support is given, because I agree with Commissioner Handley, additional support is necessary, is needed. It simply needs to be done in a way that is mutual, is respectful, and we're sitting at the table deciding how it's going to be done and have that voice.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, you know, I'm a little confused in that it sounds like we're in one way asking that the trustee become a dual superintendent, and it sounds like the contact coaches that are there to give professional development for teachers are being asked to be teachers or parallel teachers or something, and I'm just not understanding what is being asked for in the collaboration and to do other projects or do other things in the classroom besides being a content coach as a professional development worker with the existing teachers. It's a failure on my part to understand, but if you could clarify that, I'd sure appreciate it.
Surely. First of all, I must respectfully disagree that the trustee has been a big or significant influence with SIG or MAP. I made the decision to go ahead with MAP. Our current curriculum specialist has taken, or curriculum director has taken it over. We just have not, frankly, if you talk to the superintendent, the two assistants, the new curriculum director, we just have not seen value added with the trustee. That said, when you talk about the content specialists, we hired mostly new teachers last year. I'm talking new teachers to the profession because that's all we could find. We went to Denver, we went to Seattle, not Denver, but to Portland, Seattle, we went to Anchorage, and we found new teachers. They come up to Alaska, they're working with little light, cold, a new environment, new culture, and trying to adjust to the challenges of turning a school around. These folks need coaching. They need folks that can be with them, to work with them, to show them strategies, to model. I see you do. I show a back and forth modeling to really get them the idea of what it means to really be a successful teacher. That takes time, especially with our new folks. Our content specialists come in for a few days, they leave. There's been times when they see an incoming storm and they get on the next plane and they're gone. I don't blame them. They want to go home to folks and family. They don't live in our villages. But what we have is just doesn't have the time or the duration to really make an impact, plus the fact that we have little or no say in what they do when they get there. And we're not even often told exactly what they're going to be doing. We're just told they're going to this site and this site and what they're going to be doing, what their goals are. It's a bit of a mystery.
Thank you, Dr. Langdon.
Does that help?
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Excuse me, Dr. Nomek, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. I have a question. We're running really short on time here. Does 8 minutes do justice to your testimony, or should we reschedule, sir?
I can read through my testimony in 8 minutes, yes. I wouldn't be able to answer any questions.
I think it's very important to get the testimony of Dr. Nomek and give us the opportunity to hear from him. I really believe it's important to hear what he has to say. He's been out there for a long time. Excuse me, Representative Herron, would you want to come and speak at this point, or would you want to follow up with Dr. Nomek?
Oh, I'll follow.
Okay. In which case, I would like to close with just a brief thought. And my thought is this. It was never my intention to be here in this place. I did my homework during the interim. I had six meetings with the commissioner, every one of the six formal meetings, and I did my absolute best to not be here. I didn't wake up in the morning saying, you know, in a bad mood and saying, well, I'm going to, you know, pick a fight with the department. That isn't why I'm here. I spent scores of hours trying to solve the problem, trying to apply my, you know, rural experience to what's going on here. The purpose of the bill that we have here, we're certainly not trying to remove the possibility of help from the school districts. All we were trying to do was to, well, we certainly stirred up the conversation. And Representative Heron and I, after we've had all the testimony, we'll put it together in a way. And I'd certainly want to hear from the committee. I mean, now that you've heard the testimony, help us put together something good. And everybody, you've heard everybody speaking highly of Commissioner Hanley. He's not the problem. The problem is that if we end up having a new commissioner a year or two, we could end up with the same problem back. These hearings could happen again in another 2-3 years if we had a change of commissioners. What we want to do is to create an environment where superintendents can feel safe if they are being intervened, the district is being intervened, that they can know that help is coming, you know, the help, but it's going to be positive help, and that they know that they won't be testifying as Dr. Kim Langdon and Howard Diamond and Diane George have testified. So we will take up testimony from Dr. Normack. Representative Heron, appreciate your patience, and I will do a little wrap-up. My intention is to work with Representative Heron and the department to bring back some language to bring more legislative oversight. On Wednesday, February 8th, we have a joint meeting with the Senate Education Committee from 8 to 9 a.m. in room 124 to hear a report on teacher preparation, retention, and recruitment by the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska. The Senate Education Committee will adjourn, and we will continue our meeting with a superintendent presentation from Alaska Gateway School District, then a continuation of our discussion with Chairman of the State Board of Education, Esther Cox, regarding the board's annual report to the legislature. With no further business before us, we're adjourned.